This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, regret is usually looked at as a negative emotion, but our guest says there's a lot we can learn from it. He'll talk with us about his book, The Power of Regret. Now, our next guest has devoted her career to understanding why mass shootings happen, how to keep them from happening, and how to react when they do. She's a former FBI agent who was chosen by the organization to create its active shooter program after the deadly mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012. Police departments around the country have used her guidance in training programs, but sometimes those departments don't follow the recommended course of action. Police on the scene in Uvalde, Texas, waited 78 minutes to respond to the shooter in Robb Elementary School, raising questions about whether more lives could have been saved and why they didn't follow the protocol set by our guest of confronting the shooter as soon as possible. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you been trained in your workplace, whether that's a school or otherwise, on what to do in the event of an active shooter attack? Is this something your children have trained on in school? What questions do you have about how law enforcement responds to these situations? And what do you think about how to prevent them in the first place? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Catherine Schweit is a former FBI special agent who retired in 2017 after 20 years. She created and ran the agency's active shooter program. She wrote the book, Stop the Killing, How to End the Mass Shooting Crisis. Catherine, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm really thrilled to be on Wisconsin Public Radio because Milwaukee was my first office as an FBI agent.
Really? Well, welcome back to Wisconsin via the internet. You wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times about the ways that law enforcement in Uvalde apparently didn't follow the protocols for active shooter incidents. Can you tell us how they veered off course from what you might have hoped they would do?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I wrote this opinion piece with a little hesitation, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. No one wants to criticize law enforcement, and as a law enforcement officer for a long time, I certainly didn't want to. But I also felt it was my responsibility to speak up and say, hey, look, law enforcement all over the country has been trained since the Columbine High School shooting in 1999 to go directly to the shooter when an incident occurs, because the people, you know, who are out there, you know, with the shooter, have no ability to protect themselves compared to law enforcement officers who come upon the scene. But I think what we saw in Uvalde is that reasons that we really don't have all the reasons yet, but we will get, for some reasons, the law enforcement officers did not confront the shooter until more than an hour after they first engaged the shooter. And that was it's just unacceptable in terms of how we train law enforcement. And I've heard truthfully from law enforcement all over the country saying the same thing.
A couple of things that have come out with the interviews with law enforcement in Uvalde was, I think the person we all thought was in charge of the scene said he didn't think he was the commander on site. How important is it to just know who is in charge, who's making these decisions?
Oh, it's kind of law enforcement 101. You have to have somebody in charge. And generally the rule in law enforcement is the first guy on the scene or the first gal on the scene is the first one in charge. And in this case, it not only happened to be the first one on the scene, happened to be in charge, should have been in charge, but also happened to be the police chief for the very small department for the school police department, which has 6 people, not a very big department, but he was the police chief. He was first on scene with 2 local Uvalde police officers. And yet he did say in an interview that he felt like he wasn't in charge. And that's, from a law enforcement standpoint, a little incomprehensible, because that's exactly how you're trained. Incident command requires that whoever's on scene begin, take charge until the next person takes over.
Another point of concern, the judgment made apparently by the officers on the scene who were in the school at this point was that this was a barricaded suspect. The damage had already been done. There weren't lives to be saved anymore. And that apparently may have led to a lot of this delay. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, again, I think this is where I'm going to go back to just with a little bit of caution to say, mm-hmm. Department of Justice is cops office is going to go ahead and give us a minute to minutes, maybe second by second incident report. That's going to help us to have a much better picture of who was where, when, and what they did. But with all of that caution, for our listeners to appreciate that I don't have all the answers. What we do know for sure is that the officers failed to plow through and find a way to get inside. And although they got into many other classrooms and helped other children and adults out of the building, you don't have a barricaded situation when you have shooting underway. And there was shooting underway, according to the chief and other witnesses, during that whole time, you know, off and on in that time period when they were stopped at the door and not moving through, looking for maybe better equipment to protect themselves or a key to get through the doorway. All of that is going to, I think, turn out to be incredibly unacceptable. And I do understand that sometimes law enforcement can say, oh, what's a barricade situation once we get to here? But the best information we have right now is that even once the officers stopped, they were fired upon, they didn't fire back, and then there was a time period, and then there were more rounds exchanged inside the classroom, and there was still no effort to move forward. Again, from a law enforcement perspective, that's just unacceptable, even though it's a very hard thing to ask a law enforcement officer to do.
Talking to former FBI Special Agent Catherine Schweit, author of the book Stop the Killing, How to End the Mass Shooting Crisis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Kate, I want to zoom out from the particulars of the tragedy in Uvalde now. You are looking at all aspects of active shooting situations, and the best thing to do, it seems like, and you talk about this a lot, is prevent them from happening in the first place. What kind of things do we need to change, do you think, to make it so that we're not talking about police reactions, we're talking about not letting them happen at all?
No, you're right. You're absolutely right, Rob. You know, that's the situation, right? You know, when I put that book together, I found, as it turned out, that 10 of my 14 chapters were all about prevention, because prevention is the key here. And I think we have a very, as a whole, a very, we're very unaware of how much control we have over prevention efforts. While people want to look at what happens during an incident, I think if we look at before, which is the prevention part, you should know that, you know, FBI research shows 68% of these people live with somebody, meaning that somebody is around them. You know, 44% of them are employed. So we know people are around them and who sees the things. And so part of it is who can see something and help prevent it. Almost everybody, certainly family and friends. But in the case of FBI research, 92% of schoolmates specifically had the shooters leaked information specifically to the schoolmates. And that 92% was shocking to me. Then I went on to read the rest of the FBI's report on who heard about something and didn't report it. And it turned out that 87% of the spouses and domestic partners, 75% of the teachers and school staff. So a lot of people are hearing and seeing things and not reporting it, but it may be because they don't recognize what to see. What are those warning signs they should be looking for? And those really have to do with somebody who's disgruntled or who has a perceived or real grievance. So they are leaking and they're frustrated. They're leaking information to other people. They're frustrated because they want to have a right wronged, whether or not they really truly were wronged. That's part of the grievance aspect. But then there are visual signs too. They might change their appearance. They'll give away their things. 30 to 40% of these individuals are on the road to commit suicide, and they want to do that whether they finish it or not. So they'll give away their things. They'll stop taking their medication. They change their appearance. And they leave signs. They write notes. They write in their notebooks in their bedrooms. They put up signs on their walls. They put a piece of paper on the refrigerator. And it may seem like, how could you not see that? But we think the best about the people that we love and live around. And we don't want to ever think that they're going to be the ones who do that, which is frustrating, but true.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Oh, hi. I had sort of an idea that there's, in the past 20, 30 years, that there's been an increase in wealth disparity, and that in combination with easy access to guns. And your guest just commented on the suicidal aspect of it and the grievance. And And I just thought that was an interesting correlation between wealth disparity and easy access to guns.
John, thanks for the call. Kate, what do you think?
I don't have any research on that, and I try to really work with numbers, but I think that the wealth disparity may also be reflective of frustration that we see in society. We know that the kinds of stressors that have to do with, the FBI's research on the shooters themselves, 49% of them were suffering with stressors that involve financial strains. So absolutely, wealth is part of the issue. Probably mental health, job-related issues, and pretty much conflicts with your friends or your family are the other high-level issues that cause a stress. But financial stressors are right up there. Half of the people the FBI studied fell into that category. So, John, maybe you're right. You're right on the mark there.
John, thanks for the call. Kate Schweit is with us, former FBI special agent who created and ran the agency's active shooter program. She's talking to us about best practices for active shooter response, why they aren't always followed, and how to prevent active shooting situations from happening in the first place. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? Do you want to see lawmakers change laws or policies related to mass shootings? What kind of trainings have you done in your own school, your own workplace? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about active shooter prevention and response with Kate Schweit, a former FBI special agent who created and ran the agency's active shooter program. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Let's go back to our callers now. Jim is with us in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if your guest thinks it might be a good idea that school employees could be trained and allowed to defend themselves and the students with small arms, and whether she thinks it's just a coincidence that these shooting incidents we seem to be concerned about all seem to occur in gun-free zones exclusively.
Jim, thanks for the call. You've looked at this issue, Kate, the idea of arming teachers and other school staff.
Yeah, Jim, thanks for the call, because I think that question, those questions come up quite a bit. And I think that one of the things I want to clarify is the idea that shootings occur in gun-free zones is a mistaken belief. So I just want, the listeners to appreciate that the data doesn't support that. Certainly shootings occur in both gun-free and non-gun-free zones, or places where guns are taken all the time, but more of them occur in places where there isn't that type of prohibition. So that's the gun-free zone issue isn't really a discussion. And I say that I teach a class in the Second Amendment at DePaul University College of Law down in Chicago. I'm pretty familiar with the firearms and the gun regulations in and around the states. With regard to your first question, and I hear, I do hear several people often on say, should we arm teachers? Should we arm teachers? Would that be a safer way to do it? And I think here's the kind of the concerns that exist with regard to that, Jim, understanding that, I was a law enforcement officer sworn for 20 years. I have a gun, I carry, I know how to shoot. It's not about that. It's about the idea that almost every shooting in a middle school or a high school is a student at that school. A handful of them are students who have graduated. So what you're really asking a teacher to do is to raise a gun to one of their own students. And I think that many times, literally every teacher I've ever asked has said, I just can't do that. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't some locations where a teacher might be able to do that. But when a teacher hesitates to fire, then the teacher's going to be killed because it's going to be gun against gun. And I also know that, realistically, teachers get into that business to nurture. And so they're going to be inclined to see the best in their students and try to find a way to fix. So I think when we're looking, and I'm looking for big picture ways that we can solve this issue, for instance, in schools, and I mentioned before, in the school situation, there are twice as many of these types of shootings in businesses and places of business as there are in schools. So schools are about 20 to 25%, depending on what span of years you look at, where these shootings occur. Those school shootings, you're really, that's a kind of a stretch, I think, to ask a teacher. And so to do that because of the emotional issues, but I'll give you this additional information, Jim. There are some states that allow that. There are some states that are doing that now. I think we don't have any data to see how they'll turn out. And I also, you know, as a person who carried a gun, also very concerned that you're bringing another gun into the scene. And when a teacher who is fired upon is killed, then there's another weapon with more ammunition in it picked up. And I've seen that occur. And also, you know, the things that other school people have been concerned about, which is, you know, can we get enough training for those teachers? Will the teachers be able to safely secure the weapon? So arming teachers is much more complicated, I think, than, you know, so I don't see that as the best solution forward, although I do believe that we need to kind of cobble our solutions together, Jim. So it's a good concept, but I think not something that we've seen a lot of success in the long run.
Thanks, Jim, for calling in, talking to former FBI Special Agent Kate Schweit, who created and ran the agency's active shooter program, author of the book Stop the Killing, How to End the Mass Shooting Crisis. Back to your calls now. Donna is with us in Algoma. Donna, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just have a comment that I think that the gun regulations and law about the guns should be taken out of the Senate and Congress hands because they are so controlled by the NRA and the big money, and they do nothing anyways. I think it should be put to a vote for the public, to the public, and have it taken care of once and for all. And also, the teachers already are so full of responsibility, we don't need them to be armed and protecting our children.
Donna,
thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for the call, Donna. There's not a referendum process to do what Donna wants. But Kate, are there, as you look in ways to prevent mass shootings, are there firearm related regulations that you think could make a difference?
Yeah, I'm no legislative expert, but I live outside of Washington, D.C., so I can pretend I'm one. Just kidding. There, you know, the concept, as you mentioned, you know, there really isn't a methodology to take that control away from Congress. That's the representative democracy that we have, is that Congress makes those decisions, and funds them. But in addition to that, right now, most all of the gun law that impacts every citizen out there is not federal gun law. It's really state gun laws. So I think one of the things that we may see and that might help is to have some federal legislation that really helps to kind of coalesce some of the laws that are supported around the country. One example of that is the proposal now for the red flag laws. There are currently 19 states and DC, District of Columbia, that have red flag laws that that's the nickname for them, but these extreme protection laws that would allow someone to go into a court and ask a judge to order that a gun be held from 6 months to a year, depending on the state law, or more. And that would be, if there was a move, that's one of the things that's in the Senate. That's one of the things that's in the Senate and House negotiations, is to enhance red flag laws around the country and support them by providing the financial support for them. What that would do, I think, is to help to coalesce what is the most popular, which I think is your point, Donna, is if you look at the research on, you know, what do the numbers show Americans believe in terms of background checks, universal background checks, or red flag laws, or raising the age to buy a semi-automatic to 21, you know, when you can't buy a handgun at 20 at 19, but you can get a semi-automatic, you know, that's kind of questionable for me, I think. So I wonder if we could pass some federal laws that might to help coalesce some of the laws that exist in the states that might help to, again, incrementally kind of control some of the concerns without taking away, without taking away the rights of people who are just abiding by the law, which is the majority of gun owners in the United States. But there's no question we have a lot of guns here, right? 400 million guns, 120 to every 100 people in the United States or something like that.
Donna, thanks for the call. We have just a couple minutes left, Kate, and I wanted to ask you about something else you've written about, how we train school staff and students to respond in this worst case situation where there is an active shooter. You're hoping to see some changes.
Absolutely. This is one of the things that I did, the reason I did write the op-ed piece in the New York Times. Back in 13 and 14, the federal government adopted the run, hide, fight as a national policy, just like stop, drop, and roll. That concept that, and I know from fact, from being at scenes and reading about and working on them, talking to law enforcement, that everybody at these scenes, when a shooting starts, they either run or hide or fight or some combination of that. But I'm very concerned and kind of frustrated that 10 years down the road, we're still primarily only teaching students the middle part, which is the hide part, which is lockdown. And I understand the concerns that schools have, but I'm hoping that parents and school districts over the summer will take the opportunity to reevaluate the ton of training that they give to the students and the faculty, because the faculty are the ones who are going to make the decision to run. And I can tell you that we know that, for instance, there were 9 children who survived when they ran out of Sandy Hook Elementary School in one of those classrooms that was being shot up. I know about children who jumped out windows at Virginia Tech and survived when their shooter was coming through the door. There are a lot of opportunities to run, but I don't think we teach our children to do that at any level. And the challenge to that is that we would run if we were in a movie theater or a mall or a park. But why do we leave our fate in the hands of somebody with a semi-automatic weapon who's coming through the door? I think I talk to my kids about that. I think parents should talk to their kids about that.
Kate, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Catherine Schweit is a former FBI special agent who retired in 2017 after 20 years. She created and ran the agency's active shooter program. She's the author of the book, Stop the Killing, How to End the Mass Shooting Crisis. She talked to us about gaps sometimes in law enforcement training and school responses when it comes to mass shootings, and some ideas on how to prevent them in the first place. Still time for you to share your thoughts and experiences maybe in these kinds of trainings. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guest tackle students' questions about fentanyl and how to avoid it and how to prevent it from circulating in their schools. Join the conversation. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7:30. That's here on the Ideas Network. Shiver me timbers and none of your beeswax. Those two statements came together in a new discovery of a lost treasure galleon on the coast of Oregon. That's Oregon the state, not Oregon, Wisconsin. Archaeologists discovered timbers from a Spanish galleon that was lost at sea in 1693. The ship carried silk and porcelain and blocks of beeswax, which is, I guess, pretty valuable then, too, to make candles. The timbers were found in a cave on the Pacific coast. Lots of galleons went back and forth across the Pacific. Many of them disappeared over the years, but only a few of these wrecks have been found. If you want to get rich quick, there's probably a better way than searching for lost treasure galleons in the Pacific. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. You probably racked up at least a few regrets in your life. They might be small things, like wishing you left earlier when you're running late for something. Or they could be bigger things, like wishing you had the courage to ask someone out or that you chose a different career. Our next guest says those regrets are a core part of what makes us human. He says if we understand regret better, we can actually use it to our advantage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Hey, if you're willing to share, do you have a regret that's been hard for you to let go of, or have you been able to take a regret and learn from it for the next time? Have you learned things from your regrets over time? How have they changed the way you act now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Daniel Pink is a New York Times bestselling author. His latest book is The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, you lay this out right off the bat in your book. A lot of people love the concept of no regrets. Some of us even get it tattooed on ourselves. Why does this no regret idea become so widespread?
Well, I think it's because we're a little bit over-indexed on positivity. We think that we need to be positive all the time. We think that we should be looking forward all the time, that we should never look back, that when we experience a negative emotion, particularly a negative emotion like regret, we should brush it off, think positive, and move on. And the trouble with that philosophy, that no regrets philosophy, is that it runs against 50 years of science, and it's a terrible blueprint for living.
Why? Why is that a terrible blueprint for living?
Well, because regrets serve a function. Here's the thing. Regret is one of our most ubiquitous emotions. It is one of the most common emotions human beings have. It's arguably the most common negative emotion human beings have. There's 50 years of evidence showing that the only people who truly don't have regrets, right, who actually are true to this no regrets philosophy are five-year-olds because their brains haven't developed enough, people with certain kinds of brain lesions and neurodegenerative disorders, and sociopaths. The rest of us have regrets. And, you know, I don't like experiencing regret. Nobody does. So there's this puzzle about why is something so unpleasant, so widespread? And the reason is it's useful if we treat it right. And the problem is we haven't been taught how to treat it right. We think of it as something to ignore. When we can't ignore our regrets, we end up wallowing them. What we should be doing is confronting our regrets, thinking about them, using them as engines of progress.
All right. How do we do that? I look back at some of my life. I regret, A, I probably don't want to think about it. As you say, B, if I start thinking about it, I wallow in it. How do I steer that better course?
We have a lot of evidence on how to do that more effectively. It begins with how we think about ourselves and our regret. When we talk to ourselves in the face of missteps and screw-ups, we are brutal. Our self-talk is vicious and cruel, and the solution to that is stop doing that. Instead, practice something called self-compassion. Self-compassion is treating yourself with kindness rather than contempt, recognizing that your regrets are part of the human condition. You're actually not that special. If you have a regret about kindness or lack of boldness, it's very, very common. And also our mistakes are a moment in time, not the full measure of our life. And so once we treat ourselves with self-compassion, we can begin to talk about our regret, make sense of our regret, and systematically extract a lesson from it that we can apply next time.
Talking to Daniel Pink about his new book, The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Is there something in your life that you regret and that you're willing to share? Do you feel like you wallow in it? Do you try to forget about it? Or have you learned from it? Do you have questions for our guest about this, the science of regret? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dan, you've done these massive surveys, first in the United States, then a worldwide one looking at regret. What are some of the most common big regrets that people express in these surveys?
Well, what I found and actually look at, so thank you for mentioning that. So I did one big giant public opinion poll of the U.S. population that showed that when you look at sort of the main areas of people's lives, people regret a lot of different kinds of stuff. They have regrets about careers. They have regrets about education. They have regrets about health. But then I also did something called the World Regret Survey, where I just collected regrets a lot. We now have over 20,000 regrets from people in 109 countries. And what I found there, when you actually go beyond the domains of life, and I read through the first 15,000 of these, is that around the world, over and over again, people seem to share the same four regrets. Over and over again, they express the same four regrets. They have less to do with the part of life you're in, career, education, whatever, and more to do with, I think, some fundamental human longings and aspirations.
What are those main longings and aspirations that will lead us into this path of regret?
Well, I'll go through them very quickly. Foundation regrets. Foundation regrets are, if only I'd done the work. These are people who have regrets about saving too little, spending too much, about not taking care of their health, about not working hard enough in school. Again, small decisions early that add up to calamitous consequences later. Second category, boldness regrets. Boldness regrets are, if only I'd taken the chance. Again, this spans the domains of life. You mentioned one at the top of the at the show, Rob. Well, a lot of people regret not asking somebody out on a date. But these are people who regret not traveling, people who regret not starting a business, people who regret not speaking up. They're at a moment in their life when they can play it safe or take the chance. They don't take the chance, not always, but often they regret it. Third category, moral regrets. If only I'd done the right thing. These are regrets about bullying, marital infidelity, other kinds of transgressions. And finally, the fourth category, connection regrets. If only I'd reached out. Their relationships, it's regrets about relationships that have come apart or should have been intact or were intact and are no longer intact. And somebody wants to reach out, but they say it's going to be awkward. The other side's not going to care. And so they don't do it and it drifts apart further. And with remarkable regularity, people express these same four regrets.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jake is with us in Appleton. Jake, hello.
I have a question. What can we do or what are some mechanisms when we find ourselves loathing, maybe in some of these regretful type thoughts? Any help for our viewers or listeners, rather? Thanks.
Sure. Sure, Jake. So as I was mentioning earlier, one of the best things you can do is to stop. The first thing is to stop that march toward rumination. And the way to do that is to treat yourself with the same generosity and kindness and empathy you would treat somebody else. If a friend of you came to you and said, "Oh, Jake, I made this mistake," you typically wouldn't say, "You idiot, what's wrong with you? You're the worst person in the world." But that's how we talk to ourselves. And as I said before, don't do that. Treat yourself with kindness. Recognize that these mistakes, these regrets are part of the human condition. The second thing you can do, and it's really important, is to talk about it or write about the regret. When we talk about a regret or write about it, we unburden ourselves. What's more, we do something profoundly important for negative emotions. We take this abstraction, this blobby negative feeling, convert it to words, and then that's far less fearsome. These concrete words are less fearsome than the abstract emotion. And finally, we have to draw a lesson from it. We have to be explicitly draw a lesson from it. And a good way to do that is to get some remove from it and ask yourself, what would I tell my best friend to do in this situation? Or what would I want to have done 10 years from now? And so when we reframe inward and treat ourselves with kindness, when we express outward and make sense of it, and then when we move forward by drawing a lesson from it, we can begin to develop the habit of using our regrets as an engine for progress. And when we do that, there is a massive amount of evidence that it helps us in profoundly important ways. I mean, even in more reductively narrow ways, it helps us become better negotiators. It helps us become better problem solvers. It helps us become better parents. The problem is no one has taught us how to do that. And it's a very simple process.
Thanks for that question, Jake. We're talking to author Daniel Pink. His new book is called The Power of Regret: How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you try to live your life with no regrets? How is that working for you? Or have you made a point of learning from regrets, things that you see as mistakes in your past and trying to get it better the next time around? Or do you have questions about how all this regret stuff works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with author Daniel Pink about his latest book, The Power of Regret: How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. You could join in to share regrets you've had, how you've overcome them or dealt with them, or your questions about regret. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Joel on Facebook writes, "We cannot change the past, but we can certainly learn from it. Holding on to regrets or resentments destroys our ability to enjoy today." What do you think? Share your thoughts. Dan, something that struck me in your book, you share a lot of regrets that people shared in your surveys. One story that really stuck with me when it comes to Joel's comment about learning from our regrets, a woman who talked about regretting that she hadn't listened to her grandparents more, enjoyed time spent with them until it was too late, they'd passed away. She took that, though, and said, okay, as my parents age, I'm going to make sure to listen, and I'm going to make sure to take that time. Can you talk about that as an example of how we can use our regret?
Sure. It's a great story. This is a woman named Abby who lives in Phoenix, Arizona. And when she was growing up, her grandparents who lived in Indiana would come and visit for a couple of months a year to, you know, because Arizona winters are far more pleasant than Indiana winters. And when she was a kid, she hated it. She resented them being there. And then they passed away and she realized she had screwed up. And what she missed was the connection, the stories. And what she decided to do is, again, this is a great example. She could ignore it, say, no regrets, look positive, be positive, look forward, right? Or she could say, oh my God, I'm a horrible human being. This is the worst thing that anybody's ever done. Instead, she said, I feel bad. That negative feeling is a signal. It's a signal about what I value and it's a signal about what I should do next. And so she has begun systematically collecting the stories of her parents, who I think are in their early 70s at this point, making an effort to collect their stories and assemble their stories. And so she has that sense of meaning. She has that sense of purpose. And it's a good example of the best way to deal with regrets, which is to use them as information, as data, as signals.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Randy is with us in Adams. Randy, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Randy?
Well, I just think another word for regret is forgiveness. You have to learn to forgive yourself. Because most people that have regrets, it's because it's their something that they have done and that they should have done. And if they learn to forgive themselves, they can work towards, like, say you said something bad to a friend or something and you regret it. And then it just eats at you and eats at you. You got to forgive yourself for saying it. And then maybe you can go to your friend and apologize.
Randy, thanks a lot for sharing that. Dan, what do you think about the forgiveness part of this?
No, I think Randy makes a great point. I mean, what she is calling forgiveness is an aspect of self-compassion, which is, you know, treat yourself as generously as you would treat somebody else. You know, the other thing that Randy mentions is a pretty interesting distinction in the architecture of regret, which is regrets of action and regrets of inaction. Regrets about something that I did and regrets about something that I didn't do. So for things like, let's say you said something terrible to your friend, to use Randy's example, that's a regret of action. You can actually sometimes make repairs on those. You can apologize, you can make amends, you can make restitution. What's interesting is that what lives with people far longer than regrets of action are regrets of inaction. As we age, regrets of inaction, regrets about what we didn't do, outnumber regrets of action by about 2-1.
Randy, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Daniel Pink about his book, The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your stories, your questions at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dan, a thing that really strikes me here is a lot of the regrets, not all of them, but a lot of them are kind of, we become science fiction authors and craft the alternate history. What if I had gone to school or hadn't gone to school or married this person instead of that person or whatever, and our alternate history is way better than the one we're really living. How do we get over that one?
Well, it's an interesting question because sometimes our alternate history is way better than the one we're living in now. But I think what really eats at people is not knowing what that alternate history was, and also not delivering at the moment. So, for instance, I have a lot of people who regret not asking, as we talked earlier, not asking somebody out on a date or something like that. But very few of them say, oh, if I had asked him out on a date, we would be married and have three kids and, you know, living, you know, a beautiful life in Milwaukee. They're not saying that. What's gnawing at them is, in that particular case, is not stepping up at the moment of being at a juncture in their lives and having a chance to do something bold and shrinking from that chance. Now, you're right that the way we think about regret is to conjure these alternative histories. But what seems to bug people about a lot of these inaction regrets is not so much the outcome, but the decision itself.
Now, one thing about your four main buckets of regret, the foundation one where I wish I'd taken better care of myself, planned for my financial future, and so on, it seems sometimes to contrast with the boldness one. I wish I'd taken that chance. I wish I'd done this thing on the spur of the moment. How do we reconcile those two? The I wish I'd taken more risks versus I wish I'd hedged my bets better.
Yeah, that's a good question. The things that people did, I actually think there's actually a very close affinity between between having a stable foundation and having a psychologically rich life. I think that having a stable foundation allows you to take sensible choices. The foundation regrets that people were talking about were not, you know, when they spent money, they were spending money on frivolities. They weren't saying, oh, I tried to start a business and it failed, and therefore I'm in bad financial shape. I don't think I had anybody who said that. I had people who said, I earned an okay income, but I spent it going out to restaurants and buying cars and stuff that I didn't need. So the foundation regrets were very rarely a trade-off with boldness. They were something different. They were about kind of investments in oneself. It's not like people were being overly risky in compromising their foundation. They were being actually stupid in many cases. And when you have at least a stable foundation, that gives you a little bit more of the temerity to take that trip, to try something more adventurous.
We heard from Dean on the Ideas Network Facebook page, who writes, regrets equal fear of the past, worry equals fear of the future. Live in the now, Dean concludes. Easier said than done for me, Dan. I don't know. Is that normal?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not terrible advice, but I think that one of the things that you see in some of the research on the temporal side of human development and human flourishing is that what we want is in some ways an integration of the past, present, and future. What we want is we want the past to inform our present, and we want the present to guide our future. There is a very interesting personality psychologist at Northwestern University in fairly nearby Evanston, Illinois, and he says that people see their lives in terms of narratives, and there are two kinds of narratives. That he says, Dan McAdams is the guy's name. He says there are contamination narratives where things go from good to bad, and there are redemption narratives where things go from bad to good. And humans seem to flourish when they see their lives as redemption narratives. And the downside of living in the present only is that it's not a narrative. It is simply, you know, processing this particular moment and not seeing how it integrates into one's past, present, and future. And we know healthy flourishing depends, at least in part, on seeing your life in this narrative terms of making progress, of getting better, of moving from bad to good.
Dan, you talk at the end of your book about, you know, this isn't just research you've done for research's sake. It has started to seep into your life. How has your long look at regret changed your own personal behavior?
Well, on these connection regrets, I have to say it's changed it significantly. So what happens with these connection regrets is that people have these relationships, often friendships, usually not, I'm not talking about romantic relationships mostly. Think about a friendship, and the friendship comes apart. And usually they come apart in profoundly undramatic ways. They drift apart. And one side wants to reach out and they say, nope, it's going to be awkward if I reach out, and the other side's not going to care. So it drifts apart more and it feels more awkward, and they think the other side's not going to care less, and they're wrong. There's a pile of evidence showing that that reaching out is far less awkward than you think, and the other side almost always welcomes it. And so for me, it's like if I'm at a juncture where I'm saying, should I reach out or should I not reach out? Being at that juncture has answered my question. I mean, always, you know, reach out. If you're at that juncture, reach out. And that's changed me, because I'm not somebody who is like super social or super, you know, really good at reaching out. But this changed my view on it, because I had those misguided views of awkwardness and the suspicion that the other side wouldn't care. And I was flatly wrong.
Well, now, apart from reaching out, Dan, in our last minute or so, leave us with a bit of advice on how to start using regret in a happier way.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I would suggest with people is this. This week, have a conversation with someone about your regret. People want to talk about this. Tell somebody around the dinner table, in your office, hey, here's a regret that I have. here's what I've learned from it, and here's what I'm going to do about it going forward. That simple process. Here's my regret. Here's what I learned. Here's what I'm going to do about it. That will trigger one of the richer conversations that you will have this year. I can almost guarantee it. It's a topic people want to talk about. It's a topic that we've made taboo, but it's a topic that can yield very powerful lessons in what we value and how we should lead a meaningful life.
Dan, thanks so much for sharing your research with us.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Daniel Pink, author of several books. We talked to him earlier this year about his latest, The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll mark Father's Day and Juneteenth with the author of a new memoir looking at her dad's wisdom and his life in the Jim Crow South. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Dinner doesn't have to have a big entree. Build a great meal around the little things with the author of the new cookbook, Snacks for Dinner. Small bites, full plates, can't lose. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.